It is April 25th, 2012. You are listening to the Karam Cast, episode 24. I am here with my co-host, Amy Lynn Chadwick.
Howdy.
And we are going to be talking about our trip to Las Vegas, our annual pilgrimage to the NAB conference, which is the National Association of Broadcasters conference. And it's something that sounds kind of boring maybe on the surface, but it's gone in the last 7 years that I've been going from being a big meeting of minds by the television station owners across the country and the world, and transformed into a very critical new media conference where these people are now really accepting that there's been a massive shift in how content is produced and distributed, and that it will no longer be television centric, but that it's a transmedia experience, that everything that is being made and being shown is going to be distributed to phones and tablets and all sorts of devices that we don't even quite know yet. I'll tell you one thing that was unusual. There was a company called Nick, and they make OLED buttons, like little buttons that you would put on a machine of some sort. And they had like high quality video inside the actual buttons themselves. So there's no way of knowing exactly how this stuff is going to be seen in the future. But this year, I mean, you felt it, right, Amy? Like
the shift, yes. And yeah, before other years prior, it felt like everyone was freaking out. And this year it was more of a confident air into the future. Instead of content being the tagline, what was it?
It was the great content shift.
The great content shift.
So NAB went from this stance of self-defense to one of complete adoption of this, dare I say, paradigm shift. And really we're embracing the new tools and the new technologies and the new methods of communication. I'm going to just jump right into it.
Yeah.
Going back into the 3D realm, you know, there's people who might be sick of us talking about it, but it's not going to go away. I had somebody who was talking on Facebook about their concern with 3D and saying, you know, I can't wait till it goes away and it's just this gimmick. And I was arguing that, you know, you have to be careful to not sound like one of those people who said, now they've got movies that have talking in them. And he argued that it's not the same thing, that 3D is a trick, whereas talking in film was a legitimate transformation to the medium. But I say that 3D is a medium into itself. It's
That it is a transition. You're transitioning into actually seeing holograms these days and seeing 3D as movies as they are, like, real, lifelike.
Right, meaning that it's not just about things jumping out of the screen at you. But for example, we listened to James Cameron and Vincent Pace, who started the Cameron Pace Group. And Cameron, who incidentally just came up from the bottom of the ocean, I think he went down alone deeper than any person's ever gone, he doesn't mess around. And he's a major, major proponent of pushing 3D forward and getting everybody on side. And they were talking about how when they were shooting the U.S. Open and you know, the Tiger Woods, the last Tiger Woods tee off, they went from shooting it with nine 3D cameras about 3 or 4 years ago to now they're shooting it with like 30, 40 plus cameras. And that's because they've streamlined the whole process. Now the cameras are these compact little units and they have them everywhere where the normal sports cameras are. In fact, they're usually mounted on top of them. And so you're getting a far more immersive experience. And they said that the real star of the show at an open is not the golfer, but it's the course. And they really wanted to feature its beauty and its depth and whatever. They also said that the place to look for the fastest new adoption of technology is always going to be in sports, because unlike movies, which sort of last forever and they linger for 30, 40 years, sports are very time-focused. You know, it happened last Tuesday. Did you see the game? And you know who won. And you have to be able to capture the moment as it happens. Nobody really knows or can predict where it's going to go and how it's going to play out. But the audience is paying acute attention to every detail, every nuance about how the ball what angle it came in at, or whether somebody was a nanosecond to the plate before somebody else or whatever. So the technology is trying to meet that challenge of capturing sports events, and that's what's really helping push it along.
One of the places where I found that 3D really fit perfect was in the X Games, because if you watch the X Games, these people are doing crazy tricks, and it's hard to even describe some of the things that you witness. And these cameras are up close, and you're getting some of them. I think it was 3D 360 view.
Right.
Being able to be that in it, that close, and seeing exactly the technicalities that go on with this athlete. It's
right. And you really get that sense of depth and height and what's at stake in a far more intense way than if you're just looking at it two-dimensionally.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, we saw a talk by the Bandito brothers, who made a film called Act of Valor that came out this year. And they shot it with real Navy SEALs, not actors. And they shot everything with Canon 7D cameras and 5D cameras, which are these DSLR cameras. And somebody asked them if they were ever going to go into the 3D realm and try to convert their films. And they said that's impossible, because the nature of what they shoot is so dynamic and so kinetic that 3D doesn't lend itself to that at all. Like, it would just blow your brain apart, and you'd never have enough time of anything moving on screen to actually deal with the convergence of 3D. Hmm. So there are things that still have to be done in 2D, that really 2D is the only way to convey them. And there's people that are really still pushing that medium. But 3D is its own language. And I know, because when I worked on Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I mean, the workflow was decidedly different than anything else I've ever worked on. You know, it wasn't, I think I've mentioned this before, but you couldn't just jump this way or that way or move things, because, you know, you can't have a pool cue that's only halfway in frame, for example. The speed at which a camera moves across the frame or the scene has to be much more deliberate, and so on. But Cameron Pace Group has this truck now. It's called the Shadowcaster, and, you know, they showed all of these new cameras and devices and processors and all of these things. And they said, look, we're not here to sell you gear. We just want you to know these things are not going to have price tags. These are things that we've created to make our workflow easier. And we would pull up with our truck and we would help you capture whatever that event is, because it's far too advanced to just sort of throw it into the hands of fools who are, you know, or amateurs who don't really understand the workflow when you're capturing something that elaborate.
Yeah.
But there's another thing going on with the 3D realm, and that is autostereoscopic viewing. Now, autostereoscopic means that you don't need glasses to look at something that's three-dimensional.
Right.
And a couple of years ago, we saw a prototype from Japan. A Japanese company came over, probably spent $500,000 on a booth, and they had this little screen that was like 13 inches, and it looked kind of neat. You know, like one of those religious posters that you look at of the Virgin Mary, and it sort of looks like it's shifting a little bit this way and that way. Well, people have taken that idea, and not 2 years later, they've blown it up to a completely different scale. I went by the Sprint booth, and they had a 35, 36-inch display that was showing autostereoscopic images, and it had a huge field of view. You know, normally it was like about 45 degrees within which you could see the three-dimensionality before it started to break. But this was like you could walk almost from one edge of the screen all the way in a big semicircle to the other side, and it was still looking really good.
How was that in comparison with the Sony booth? Because I didn't see the Sprint booth.
Well, So Sony is now also talking about this technology, and they showed some prototypes, which is big stuff when Sony gets behind it.
Yeah.
But basically what it is it, the screen itself isn't doing much. There's software that's written that takes the image and it creates 9 or 12 artificial cameras around that image. So they're multiple views. And yes, the footage does have to be that way from the beginning. You can't just take anything and convert it this way yet. It has to have at least two different points of view that it's taking and saying, okay, now I'm going to move it a little bit this way, a little bit this way, a little bit this way. And that way you can kind of get a semicircle around the object. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the software basically creates like 9 or 12 camera views, and they're sliced up in little pieces. And then they put this plastic screen over top, and it sort of looks like a honeycomb in a way. And what that does is it breaks up the light, and it sort of refocuses it depending on where you're standing. The Sprint one actually looked amazing. I couldn't believe it. And it was designed to be an ad. So the kind of thing where you're at a bus stop and you'll be seeing three-dimensional images from 9 points of view as you walk around it.
Wow.
And it looked really amazing. And that was, I spoke to the guy, the inventor of that technology's father, who was at the booth. And apparently his kid who made it was 24 years old. And I'm going to try to get an interview with him in an upcoming episode.
Do it, because that sounds a lot cooler than, no offense, what Sony had.
So why did you not like the Sony one?
Well, there was 3 different sizes of screens. The large screen was playing this video of this woman dancing in a waterfall. And it didn't look 3D to me. And the range of where you could stand was very small. I don't know if my eyes were tired that day. The middle screen was the best one, the middle-sized one. Maybe it was about 15 inches or so. That was okay, but it still didn't give you that, or me anyway, it didn't give me that 3D feeling.
They also showed, at Sony, they showed like a netbook, and it had the smallest screen, obviously. And what they did on there was a little box in the top left that showed your face. And it was tracking your face as you moved around the computer. So it was actually adjusting itself in real time to your position and optimizing the image for where you were standing in comparison to it.
Yeah.
Now, there you go. I mean, that's sort of one of the ways that they're going to solve this. Obviously, you know, you're not going to always see a picture of your face in the top corner, but with Kinects and everything, it's already possible. You know, because a Kinect measures not just horizontal and vertical space, but it also measures depth and contrast. And then there's a Kinect 2 coming out, and so who knows what else it will be able to measure, or how much more specifically.
When's the Kinect 2 coming out?
Pretty much the time when the next Xbox is coming out, and there's a lot of speculation and rumor about when and what it will be, but it'll come out around then. And I mean, I'm just saying, if you fast forward a year, and you think about it, you know, with the Sony thing, I asked them, how are you going to buy this? Like, would you buy a computer that does this and then whatever? And they said, no, you would basically go and buy the plastic piece that goes over top of your screen for, you know, $80 to $100.
And the software or something?
And the software. And then you install it and boom, there you go. You don't have to wear glasses. So to my friend on Facebook who was arguing about, oh, I don't like wearing the glasses and I feel stupid and they're a pain and sometimes and they get smudgy. Well, it's not really going to stay that way. I mean, in cinema, it is. No, undoubtedly, in cinema, they're not going to start putting these giant plastic things over the screen to do auto stereoscopic yet.
Yeah.
It's much more advantageous to have those glasses that can deal with whatever technology that you're looking at in 3D. There's 3Ality. There's a bunch of different companies that have different approaches to how they deal with it. I talked to the 3Ality guys at the show too, and they were showing the camera that they used to film the new Ridley Scott movie, Prometheus, and it's called the Atom camera, and it's a big old thing. I mean, it must weigh 60 to 80 pounds, maybe a little less. And they showed the new prototype camera that was coming after it, which was already way more streamlined. It weighed half the amount, and it had better optics, it had better servo parts and all of this stuff. So I'm not saying that to geek out, I'm just saying that the iteration of the technology is happening very quickly. You know, you're going from one workflow and then 6 months later, they've already improved it, you know, 2 times, 3 times over. So I think it's way, way too soon to be talking about the death of 3D when the major forces behind it are pushing really hard.
Yeah, it's just begun. I mean, 3 years ago, people were saying the death of 3D already and it hasn't died.
You can't say the death of something is going to happen when you're just taking your baby steps.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, we can say, oh, well, obviously 3D TVs didn't sell because nobody wants them. But that's, you know, that's like saying that no one was ever going to want high definition television because plasma screens cost $10,000.
Yeah. And it's not entirely true. I know a lot more people now than 6 months ago that are starting to jump on the 3D TV bandwagon.
Now, let's also talk about quality of image. You think that an HD TV now, and let me just point out, only about 10% of households even have an HD TV. right now, the resolution of a high-definition television set or screen is usually 1920 by 1080 pixels, right? 1,920 pixels by 1080. They're already talking about cameras and projectors and screens that are going to be 4K resolution. So that's not just double, but it's like quadruple the amount of pixels that you're getting inside of that screen. And they, in fact, have shown a life-size screen, you know, 70 inches high with people that are full human height. That's a 4K or even 8K screen resolution. And they say it's just, it's impossible to believe how realistic it looks. Of course, we probably used to think that, you know, color TVs were so lifelike.
Yeah, I did.
But let me just say that go back now and look at an old VHS tape on your crappy old TV and you will not believe what we used to tolerate.
I know.
So now all the companies are talking about 4K workflows and capturing 4K, and that is a huge amount of data that you are capturing. Like, for example, to capture 1 minute of 4K resolution video takes 100 gigs. I don't even think that's... Yeah, that's not a second. I think that's a minute. Or is it a second? 100 gigs? It's something ridiculous. But it's like the kind of hard drive storage and everything that we're going to be looking at in a year or two is going to make today just seem like a joke.
Right.
Just like we look at the Atari 2600 and go, well, that thing had 8K of memory or whatever.
Yeah.
We're going to be moving into words like petabytes and yottabytes. Now, we're not going to be storing yottabytes. Yottabyte is the biggest number for which we actually still have a word.
Yotta?
A yottabyte.
Yottabyte.
It's big. Really, 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 really big.
And where do they store these yottabytes?
Well, when I start talking about the privacy in this country and the surveillance that's going to be taking place in a year, I'll start talking about yottabytes.
Oh, okay.
But right now we're into terabyte land, and mm-hmm. soon terabytes are going to seem like gigabytes, and then petabytes are going to seem like terabytes. It's just going to get bigger and crazier. I already have, I don't know, like what, 30 hard drives in this studio?
And then some.
Just keeping them cooled off, keeping redundant copies. I mean, one of the big things that people are freaking out about now is how you actually deal with storage and archival of stuff. Because we used to think, oh, you know, just back it up, make a copy. But in fact, they say you have to make two copies, one on site and then another copy somewhere else.
Yep.
And when you're talking about, you know, 15, 20 minutes of footage at 4K, you're talking about multiple terabyte drives just to back up that 15 or 20 minutes. So things are going to have to change. And we're clearly at the very beginnings of what's possible and not nearly at the consumer level with these things yet.
And are you opposed to the cloud?
Well, no. I mean, the cloud is the other solution. This year at NAB, there was a whole conference track about just the cloud, you know, and what the cloud means and cloud security and its stability and all of that kind of stuff. The thing about the cloud is that you are putting your stuff in someone else's control, effectively.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be comfortable with that yet.
The idea is that, you know, if your stuff goes down or whatever, then you have this remote backup. But what happens when, and this is going to segue me into the next big topic, what happens when you don't have access to the internet in the way that you would like, or when your footage or your material or whatever your IP or intellectual property or content is in a place that the government actually legally has permission to snoop around, then the cloud doesn't seem like such a good idea. Just before we get into all that, though, in theory, the cloud is amazing. I can just pay Amazon $100 a year and I can store everything I have in their powerful maintained servers and I don't have to worry about dealing with it myself. And I can pull it down from anywhere I am in the world and I can just use like a thin client. And a thin client is just a basically a dumb computer. It doesn't have any processing power or anything. It's just like a screen that, like a window that looks at their supercomputer, and you can use all of the software that you want and everything just through that little window.
That's so crazy.
So you don't have to buy these super powerful computers. You can just rent all of the processing power you could ever want from a massive company like, you know, Amazon or Google or whatever the other ones are. But let's talk about privacy and stuff for a second. I occasionally put up little petitions and stuff on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter about countering these acts that the government and Congress are trying to push through, things like SOPA and PIPA and now CISPA.
CISPA, now, I got an email for that today.
Yeah, these are, you know, cute little names, and we sort of sign the thing and send it off, or sometimes we say, no, I do support that because we should curb piracy and, you know, there should be protection and whatever. So let's break down what some of these things actually mean.
Okay.
SOPA stands for Stop Online Piracy Act. And its sister act, PIPA, which is the Protect IP, Intellectual Property Act, the Protect Intellectual Property Act. So these were two bills that were really being supported by Hollywood and the MPAA, which is the people that rate movies restricted or PG or whatever, and a bunch of other entertainment-based conglomerates and corporations who said, listen, we're sick of being pirated. We're sick of there being these websites that can just, you know, take whatever they want. They make money off of advertising. They pay nothing back, and they're destroying our industries. Well, it's okay as an argument. I mean, it's fair enough. But unfortunately, what they fail to understand is that they're going and basically trying to build dams in front of sources of water that are the lifeblood of all sorts of ecosystems. And you cannot allow Pepsi Cola to have ownership or claim over the outlet of a source of water. Do you know what I mean? It's just too dangerous. You can't say Paramount, oh yeah, Paramount, we'll give you the valve that decides how much openness or privacy you're going to get. It's just not the way the internet is supposed to work. You have to think of the internet as a natural resource. So any kind of bill, and this is the reason, to all my lawyer friends, to all my anti-piracy advocate friends, I get you. I understand it's important to protect people's content. It's valuable. We do have to understand the distinction. We have to understand that digital assets are not meaningless and they can't just be traded at will. But you can't mess with the internet in that way. You cannot allow a government to have that sort of control. So they got shut down pretty fast by major, major efforts by the public. And they sort of walked away with their tail between their legs going, oh, gee, we didn't realize how much resistance there was to all of this. You know, the president of Paramount went and did a college tour and he tried to explain his position. They said, dude, it's fine. We get what you're saying, but you're not making any arguments for how this is not a violation of freedom of speech and, you know, whatever else, of just privacy and security and all of that kind of stuff. You're dealing with too big of an entity with your little concern. So stop making a big old noise that way. Go find a better solution or build a new business model or whatever, right?
Right.
So its follow-up is this far more nefarious thing called CISPA. And first of all, it stands for the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. Okay. The problem with CISPA is that it actually removes all of the stuff about intellectual property and rights and all of that kind of stuff where it's like, you know, stop piracy, and it just deals with the government's ability to survey and basically snoop through whatever data it feels may pose a threat. Interestingly enough, unlike with SOPA and PIPA, where people had to appeal directly to Obama and say, what are you doing? Back off. And what kind of a president are you? We just got news today that he's actually threatened to veto CISPA if it makes its way through Congress. So it may be sort of influenced by the major outcry that's going on. But the White House's letter expresses the following. It says, the White House says that any cybersecurity legislation must preserve Americans' privacy, data confidentiality, and civil liberties, and recognize the civilian nature of cyberspace. It goes on to say, the bill also lacks sufficient limitations on the sharing of personally identifiable information between private entities and does not contain adequate oversight or accountability measures necessary to ensure that the data is used only for appropriate purposes. Okay, well, that's interesting because while that's happening, Wired magazine did an exclusive this last month on a National Security Agency initiative, they're building a massive surveillance center in the Utah desert. And they've been sort of hitting and missing for the last 10 years, and they've had sort of a notoriety for getting intelligence stuff wrong and whatever. But this thing is no joke. This is a $2 billion facility deep in the Utah desert in Bluffdale that's going to cover 1 million square feet, and it's opening in 2013. And it's going to have two 25,000 square foot server rooms that are designed to do little more than process all of the data moving through the internet and find patterns and basically flag anything that represents anything that the NSA considers to be a potential threat. Which means if you decide to say some smack about whatever thing that happens to go against whatever thing, you could get flagged and you're now effectively on the radar. What's frightening, though, is since the Patriot Act 10 years ago, although it was illegal, they have been recording all the data and storing it. Now, they haven't had a way up until now to actually break that data down or process it or figure out, you know, who, if John Smith and John Smith on the same street are the same person or not. But with this new center, they will. And they will be able to break 128-bit encryption, which before, they said if you tried to run an algorithm that was trying to break 128-bit encryption just by random guessing, it would take for the rest of the universe to actually do it. With this new facility, they expect that it'll be able to eventually break that kind of encryption in 10 years. That's how fast these computers are. This is where we get into yottabytes. Yottabytes being these are computers that are so fast that they're processing not at gigahertz levels, but at petahertz levels. And they can store more data than your mind can possibly figure out. Now, everything you're doing right now on Facebook, everything that you're doing right now on Twitter, every email that you're sending, every phone call that you're making, because the NSA does have their own sequestered, locked off room in every phone hub in the US, like at the major switch centers, AT&T, Verizon, these have all been installed. So everything that goes through those goes through that room before it goes out anywhere else.
I hate using the phone.
All of that has been recorded. Now, in a year, they're going to actually be able to go backwards and say, oh, so that's what's been going on. And that's what she's been saying. And that's what, and these kinds of things like CISPA are basically starting to find a way to make all of that legal. And it's Skynet. It's basically just being able to say, oh, I know what you're saying. I know what you're doing. I've got you recorded on. And it's so fast and so powerful that all of those video cameras all up and down the street, all those webcams, all those Kinects, all those phone calls, all that Twitter, your credit card use, your everything that you do is going to be data mined, not by humans, but by computers that are so fast that anything that like forms a pattern will flag you. I'm just saying. Now, that might not even be a concern. People might say, hey, I don't care, man. All my stuff's out there anyways. I got nothing to hide, blah, blah, blah. Right, that's now. President Obama is the president. But what about 10 years from now? What about if you get some autocratic, psychopathic person in power, or just anything, that suddenly is able to decide what to do with that information and how to use it? I'm already going to be flagged for saying something like this. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
However, the trick is everybody go out and buy 10 different typewriters. I mean, analog typewriters. And you start typing letters to each other that you send through the mail or by, you know, carrier pigeon. And you use cash currency. And that's basically what you'd have to do. So one of the seminars that I sat at, there was a military and government seminar about the latest technology. And this guy started speaking to them, that particular audience, about the algorithms that he was working with and how to understand, how to have better data mining, how to essentially write algorithms that can use this data and figure them out better. And I will share some of the excerpts of his talk just to give you a opportunity to make the decision for yourself about how they feel about your privacy and this data.
A lot of organizations today are building special analytics around different kinds of data, like, oh, red puzzle pieces. Oh, open source, let's build open source analytics. Oh, social media, let's build social media analytics or structured data analytics. And that's just like specialty analytics on individual puzzle pieces, and it starts to flatten out what's possible. I'll give you a notion about facial recognition. Facial recognition still doesn't work. Facial recognition by itself, it didn't work in 96. It only works when it's one-to-one or one-to-few. It doesn't work when one-to-many. You can't take a face and then search all the faces on Earth and see if it matches. But then the question is, well, geez, how come it's getting pretty damn good on Facebook? I'll tell you why it's working. It's because they've commingled streams. They're taking the social data. They're taking other photos you've been in with other people, and they're using that as the bidding list or the short list, the candidates. It makes it one-to-few. Suddenly it starts to look like it worked. We're going to see a lot of that where very diverse data is woven together, and the quality of the predictions that you can make out of previous data that was very hard to make useful is going to become useful. And I think space-time is going to be these really high-order bits. There are some companies that are putting antennas up inside of shopping malls to watch how we move inside the mall. They're doing time motion studies to say people that stand in front of this door don't go in, and people that go into that store almost always go into this store, so they can optimize layouts in shopping malls. That's fascinating. I'll tell you, after I bumped into this, as I look around, there's another company out there that's putting antennas up around prisons, three I think, and they're telling you X, Y, Z where every cell phone is in the prison, and they'll not only tell you what cell it is, but they'll tell you in which bunk and on which end of the bunk. I do think the data is what's valuable. I've had this conversation the other day about what comes next, by the way, and maybe the first big thing of value was the network happened, the big trend. And then Web 2.0 happened, where the data's happening. And I think the next thing that's gonna happen, my prediction, is it's gonna be low latencies, the next place to win. If a lot of people can see a lot of data, then the question is how fast can you see the data and make a decision faster than your competitor? So I think the next battleground is latency. So here comes a new piece of data. It doesn't matter whether it's a transactional system, mobile data, or social data. And that's data finds data. And only after it lands, then, do you say, is this good news or bad news? Sell it or shoot it. In some cases, you might want to put an ad on the web page or tell somebody that, yes, they can have the credit increase or not. And that's relevance finds the sensor. And here comes another piece of data, and it figures out where it belongs. And only after it lands, then, you say, what should I do with it? In this case, we're going to go, wow, I need to give this to a human. This is worth human attention, directing humans' attention to this. This is data finds data, relevance finds you.
So the real question is, what can you say to help emphasize the facts to the military, government, and crowd here to work that is that you have to keep the data, you have to have the metadata, it needs to be geospatially aware, and how are we going to, you know, the overterm used is cloud, but all this is going to show up in a cloud, and then we're going to do big data on it.
I think you worded that so well. If you wanted to just write that up, I'd sign it with you. I would only add that if you don't remember what you've seen, then you have no recall, and you risk living a life like Groundhog Day. But I like the way you said it better.
That was Jeff Jonas, Chief Scientist, IBM Entity Analytics Group, and an IBM Distinguished Engineer, doing the keynote at NAB 2012 for the Military and Government Summit called Big Data, New Physics. The thing is, nobody's explicitly out to get you. What I'm saying is, you're surrendering this information voluntarily. As this guy pointed out, nobody reads the terms of use when they sign up for free mail. But by doing so, you're giving it all up. You're saying, I'm giving you permission to store my data. And Tim Berners-Lee, who is the inventor of the internet as we know it, is really in a tizzy about all of this stuff. He says, I do not like the way that these companies are handling your data. Your data should be yours. It should be on your hard drive. It should be available to you in whatever way that you want. But Facebook stores your data, and they don't have to give it to you. You can download a backup of all of your stuff, but not in all of those companies. You're giving them assets. You're in the same way that SOPA says, I want to see protection for my intellectual property, well, we're creating an intellectual property that's making Facebook millions and billions of dollars. I mean, Facebook, now that it's gone public, is worth $2 billion, $5 billion. It's worth $5 billion, right? It's built on your ideas and my ideas and your photographs and my music and your videos and my videos. They don't create that content at all. Facebook does not create content. iTunes does not create content. Yes, HBO and Netflix create content, but they're worth, what, $1 billion each? Maybe. Netflix is worth maybe $200 million. But Facebook doesn't, and they keep it all. And they can use it in whatever way they pretty much feel like, oh, they're not going to overtly break your privacy. That's going to be the job of the NSA when they basically comb through all of your information. So there's my spiel on SOPA, PIPA, and CISPA, and why, yes, for the very little amount that it counts, you should sign those petitions.
And they're doing a vote on Friday, aren't they?
Yeah. And so, when CISPA goes by, there'll be another one, but you got to keep your eye out. The thing that's scary about it is CISPA is way more insidious than SOPA ever was. It doesn't even have an interest in the small companies, in the content producers anymore. It's just straight up surveillance stuff. And in case you think, oh, you know, they don't have enough processing to deal with the whole internet. Yeah, they do. They're building this thing. I mean, this facility in Utah is like the state of Rhode Island. I mean,
there's a map of it in Wired, right?
Yeah.
It's huge. Grab Wired.
They've got water storage that can pump 1.7 million gallons of liquid per day just to cool the servers. It has walls that can stop a 15,000-pound truck moving at 50 miles an hour. It's got 60,000 tons of cooling equipment. And it's got an electrical substation that can serve the center's 65 megawatt demand. I mean, this is just a computer setup designed to analyze the data that you're moving through the internet right now. So you don't have a chance.
Yeah.
Welcome to the new age. I'm going to talk about a couple of other cool pieces of gear I saw at the NAB show.
Okay.
Since we've all been shooting on Canon 7Ds and 5Ds and all this stuff, we were kind of waiting to see, well, what's going to happen next? You know, the 7D was just a camera that Canon said, well, why don't we let it shoot 30 frames per second and then 24 frames per second? And people said, oh my God, with interchangeable lenses and shallow depth of field, this looks cinematic. We can shoot real movies on this stuff and it's only $1,500. So it changed the world.
Yeah.
Everybody went from making crappy YouTube webcam videos of their heads in front of a white wall to making beautiful looking things, but with the same kind of intimacy and personal nature and immediacy. So then Canon finally thought, hey, you know, we should give it a different form factor to make it feel more like a video camera. So they came out with this thing called the C300. And the C300 is a $15,000 version, and it improves a couple of little things, but it's still kind of the same sensor and everything. It's not that big of a difference. Not 3 months later, they came out with the C500, which is the same thing as a 7D, except that it shoots 4K video, raw. And I won't get too technical for some of the audience that doesn't have much interest in that stuff. And I thought, okay, now the C500 is $30,000. So now it's not the same thing anymore. Now they're just trying to compete with the Red cameras and the Aeroflex Alexa camera. You saw a short film by Jeff Cronenweth.
Yeah, I loved it.
Shot on the C500. How did it look?
It looked so good. It was so clear in the colors. It was awesome.
Did it look like video to you?
No.
Did it look like digital film?
I thought it looked fantastic.
Different than the 7D stuff.
Yeah, there was something different about it, but it wasn't like digital.
Was it $28,000 better looking than a 7D?
I don't remember. I was really into the story.
All right. Well, that's good. So the actual medium didn't get in the way of the story.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is important. Unlike when we saw Indie Game the movie, which we'll talk about just for a second.
Yeah.
You know, it was a pretty cool story. I mean, they did a really good cut. It had a nice style. But I could definitely feel on the big screen that it was shot on a 7D. I could see kind of grain and banding and... But I could see a lot of digital artifacts.
Not all 7D things that I've seen look bad.
No. I mean, in the hands of the right person,
yeah,
they can work with its limitations and really pull it off, like the Bandito brothers did with Act of Valor.
You've shot some fantastic stuff on the 7D.
I do okay. I mean, I have a certificate in cinematography and I understand those things.
Yeah.
So anyways, the point is, a bunch of new cameras came out, but they were still really expensive. And so the 7D was like, yeah, but this thing is still $1,500. Then, out of nowhere, this company called Blackmagic, who used to make basically capture cards where you could transfer your HD footage into your computer. Then they bought the color correction company, DaVinci, and that was like the biggest color correction sort of software and hardware in the world. And they made that affordable. Well, out of the blue this year, they come out with their own camera. And they've never made a camera before. And this thing is called the Blackmagic Cinema Camera. And the cameras that we've been talking about shoot 8-bit color. 8-bit means that you're compromising on the gradients between things, the nice, gentle slopes of transition between a foggy, distant city, you know? At a certain point, that lack of bits makes those things look a little more digital.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing about film that's beautiful is that it's infinite amount of information. It's analog. There's no ones and zeros. So the higher the bits that you have, the more data you can capture in those gradients and those gentle transitions between grays and blacks and whites and reds and blues and greens. And it has a more pleasing effect to the eye. Anyway, Blackmagic puts out this camera. It shoots 12 bits, not 8, not 10, 12 bits, raw footage, which means you can, after the fact, push around the colors and the contrast like an extreme. You have 13 stops of lighting range. And instead of using compact flash cards or SD cards, it uses solid state drives, which are not like mechanical hard drives, but those new drives that are basically as fast as RAM. And you can store 480 gigs on one of those solid state drives. And you shove the whole drive right into the camera. And we looked at some footage and it's unbelievable. And I was like, oh my God, this camera came out of nowhere and it just got everything right. And it's got a 5-inch screen on the back, touch screen with vector scopes, and you can input metadata.
Price tag.
Okay, it's not $30,000. It's not $80,000 like an Arri Alexa. It's not $30,000 like the C500. It's not $15,000 or even $9,000.
It's
$2,900.
Ooh.
It's under $3,000, this camera. It accepts EF lenses, which is the Canon format, PL mount. Thing's unbelievable. Totally the highlight of the show. I'm sorry I'm geeking so hard on it,
yeah.
But it's a revolutionary moment.
It's small and compact too, huh?
Yeah. It shoots, I mean, raw. It shoots, you know, it's got a massive sensor. Anyways, that's pretty much what I'm going to say about NAB. Betty White got honored and inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Breakfast with Betty.
And
Gary Marshall was
there. Gary Marshall. He was great.
He was a hoot. I liked seeing Gary Marshall. That was really interesting.
Let's talk about a couple apps. What are the
sure.
apps of the month?
The apps of the month. Let's see. That Draw Something app just did a big old overhaul. They added some new cool features.
So we've never talked about Draw Something before.
No, it kind of came out of nowhere about maybe a month ago. I became quickly addicted and then quickly over it.
Oh, yeah?
Oh,
well,
yeah.
You were pretty addicted when you were into it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you were like hardcore, like fall over the curb because you're looking down at your phone kind of into it.
Because I was drawing so hard. Yeah.
So what was it about it that was so so cool?
Because
I never played it. I never used it.
Yeah. And I mean, the luster wore off of it. But it was the fact that it just felt like one of those old Pictionary games with your family or whatever. But you could get as detailed as you want. I was getting some pretty crazy pictures. It was fun. I'd laugh out loud.
What's the interest, though? What's the gimmick? Is it that you can see the other person drawing it?
Yeah. I mean, I have a couple friends on there that are actual artists, really good drawers. And surprisingly, watching them draw in real time, I learned a couple tips, little tricks.
So there's an interactivity that made that game successful.
Yeah, and then they added the feature of, because people were, if they were getting frustrated, they'd just write the word, that's no fun. So now you can send each other comments after instead of commenting on it. And you can give them hints or comments without actually having to do it on your drawing.
Now, the reason I'm pushing you on this to understand it is not because I'm like, oh, big deal, a drawing app. It's because the thing has 50 million users.
Yeah.
And it's a company of 12.
Right.
Unlike Zynga, which is 12. A company of 1,000 people.
12.
So 12 people wrote an app that 50 million people adopted in like the course of 3 or 4 months.
So is Instagram right now. It's another app for you.
And Facebook just happened to pay $1 billion for Instagram.
And how many people worked at Instagram?
They talked Instagram down from 2 billion. So Instagram wanted 2 billion. Facebook's like, I'll give you $1 billion. Okay, deal.
12 people.
Here's what's amazing.
Don't quote me.
I remember when people were freaking out when Google bought YouTube for $2 billion. People were like, oh my God, they spent $2 billion on a video site? Give me a break. Instagram just got bought for $1 billion.
Yeah.
Because I think $2 billion is a bargain for YouTube.
A real bargain. That's surprising. I thought it was five. No, Facebook got bought for five, right?
Facebook didn't get bought for five. Facebook is valuated at $5 billion after it went public. We've talked about, you know, Truffle, who's not with us today. He's traveling the seas. He actually, you know, he sort of kept ramping us up to this IPO, whether Facebook would ever go public. The one thing I want to say about that is that Mark Zuckerberg is going to be in a very different position than he's used to being. He used to be able to run the show the way he wanted it, and he could play a real hard line and say, this is the way I want it, and no, I'm not going to listen to you, and nobody else gets to tell me. Dude, that's not the same case when you've got thousands of stockholders.
Yeah.
Even though he still owns a majority share, he's going to have to listen to all kinds of other people's rhetoric and ideas about what Facebook really should be. And just to bring this full circle, while we're talking about massive processing data centers in Utah and the fact that we don't read terms of use agreements and we agree to them anyways, even when we don't like them, Facebook is a publicly traded company, people. This is no longer your little underground way to hang out with your friends. Just understand that. That is just what you think, but it's not what it used to be.
I know.
While you've been busy posting every little detail about your life
that you can't delete,
this has become a billboard in Times Square broadcasting who you are and where you are and who you know and what you think about all the time. Just remember that.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else? Any final comments, notes?
I was just going to ask you if you've seen any good movies lately.
Love John Carter.
I loved John Carter too.
John Carter was based on Edgar Rice Burroughs, the guy who wrote the original Tarzan books. He wrote a series called John Carter of Mars. Disney completely blew it and did not know how to market it. So they chop off the of Mars part and they put these billboards up for a $250 million movie. And they call it John Carter. Who cares about a thing called John Carter?
Well, the title actually intrigued me because I like Pocahontas.
Right.
But no, I enjoyed that movie. Hunger Games.
Hunger Games.
You still have to see it. We can talk about it next time.
But you saw Hunger Games on the midnight screening at the beginning.
I did. I hurried and read all the books and then I watched it.
And it was like the third biggest opening of all time.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Good for Lionsgate.
Yeah. The director is actually there.
Cool.
Saying hi to everybody beforehand.
And then you heard them talk about how they designed the sound at NAB.
I did.
You want to give us a second or two about that?
Basically, they got into the bees, the Tracker Jackers, and how the sounds that they created was another character. Because the movie is, they wanted it to give a feel of looking through the eyes of Katniss and what she's going through, and so sound was really, really important.
I heard that sort of echoed in an interview they did in Mix Magazine, where they said that they really didn't approach it as a blockbuster, sort of over-the-top Transformers, explosions everywhere for every single thing.
Yeah, no.
They wanted it to be a far more intimate experience, despite the fact that you're in a massive domed, you know, death forest.
Exactly.
So I think that intimacy was what the people connected to. I think that's why there's been repeat viewers. It's the Titanic effect. It's, you know, maybe a massive setting, but really what it boils down to is who is the central character and how close can you feel with them?
Yeah.
I think those sprawling epics that try to do all of that overwhelming you stuff fail because
flashy over the
they
top.
Don't have a connection enough to the central person.
Right.
It doesn't feel like there's a human in the midst of it.
Well, if I may say, I feel like a little piece of Winter's Bone was in this movie. And I'm sure that's why Jennifer Lawrence got pinned as Katniss. I think she's perfect for it.
Excellent. It was just the right combination of things in the right measure.
Yeah. I want to see the movie again before I, you know, officially say I like it just as much as the books.
Yeah.
Because the books I liked a
lot. And full circle, we also saw Pina 3D, which is Wim Wenders' 3D doc about the choreographer.
Breathtaking.
And listen, folks, if you're not quite sure about 3D yet, go see this thing. It's a masterwork, and it's beautiful, and it's uplifting. And yeah, it's about interpretive dance. Deal with it. Get over
so
it.
So good.
That's something that's got to be seen in that version. And I'll tell you why. Because the director's idea of it was affected and mitigated by his interest in making it three-dimensional.
And I've never seen 3D that good before. Mm-hmm. That was the best I've seen to date.
Yeah, it was artful. It shows that it's its own language.
Yes.
Its own poetry. All right, so we better cut it short for now. I'm shooting True Blood next week.
Holla.
Just a little kicker. So maybe at some point I'll be able to talk about it. I can't until it happens.
No, well, good luck with that.
Thanks. We'll see what happens, and I'll bring it up in the next podcast or two.
Yeah, you better fill us in.
All right, I will fill you in. Thank you for joining me again, Amy.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Where can we find you online?
You can find me at Amy, AIMEEL Chadwick on
That's
Twitter.
That's on Twitter? All right, cool.
Do it.
And all my links are, and my links and the podcast links are at karamsongs.com under the links banner. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
We love you. Bye.